I'm going to read this and try to not sound like I'm reading. All right. All right, so welcome to our latest installment of the Michigan Writers Series. This is a series of talks that the library puts on from time to time to feature the work of Michigan writers and the library services and collections that help us bring those writers' work to you. Today we're excited to have Lansing punk legend and punk fanzine purveyor Tesco V with us. And I'm just going to say a little something about the special reason that we've invited Tesco here today. So my name is Joshua Barton. I'm a catalog librarian here. And among the things that I'm responsible for is cataloging serials in our special collections library. So these are often ephemeral, unusual kinds of things. And a couple years ago, I had the chance to catalog a collection of punk fanzines from the UK dating from 1976 to 1983 or so. So these are like early years for punk. And these things were sitting in this building, uncataloged, inaccessible, and mostly unknown to everyone working here for over 20 years or so. And so once I cataloged them, that instantly made MSU one of the leaders in primary source punk literature. So, and I've got a bunch of them in the back of the room that I've brought up with me today, just a small selection of the over 170 titles that we have. And it's a collection that's growing as more donations are coming in of not just UK stuff, but stuff from the US as well. So you're all welcome to come take a look at those that I've brought up after the talk. So these zines, right, are punk's literature. These are the text and the graphics of the movement written and created by the people that shaped and made the scene. And Tesco V is one of those people. Hundreds of zine titles sprung out of the United Kingdom and throughout the States, but few had the stamina and the reach to last more than a few years or across regions. The UK had Sniff and Glue and Chainsaw. New York City had Punk by Legs McNeil. And San Francisco had Search and Destroy. Lansing, Michigan had Touch and Go. Touch and Go was launched by Tesco V and Dave Stimson and was one of the few punk zines to last long enough and reach far enough to have some kind of important impact. Tesco and Dave had this original vitriolic wit that heralded punk not just in the Midwest but from coast to coast, as evidenced by glowing reminiscences from the likes of Ian McKay of Minor Threat and Fugazi and Henry Rollins of Black Flag. And so both of those guys have contributed to the introduction of the book-length compilation of all the issues of Touch and Go that came out this year, and Tesco has some with him here today. So, Better for Sale. That's right.
Signed. Ooh.
There you go.
I scared myself. Sorry.
So along with the Touch and Go zine as a key early project, Tesco has also led the influential band The Meat Men, Tesco V's Hate Police, and he launched Touch and Go Records, which became a very important independent music label in Chicago. So given his connection to punk zines and the collection that we have growing here, join me now in welcoming Tesco V.
Thank you. It's good to be here. It's only fitting that I do this talk here at Michigan State because I am a proud alumni class of 1978, proud Spartan. And so... there's many correlations between this university and this book. Beginning, let's just a quick anecdote before I dig into the whole deal. I want to make this really informal. If you guys have questions and you say, you know, you have a question, you want me to stop where I am, just ask, you know, go for it. My first exposure to punk was at Paramount News over here where the Chipotle is now. And I remember going in and seeing a New Musical Express, and it had the Bromley contingent, which is like Billy Idol, Susie Sue, Johnny Rotten. There's this famous picture where they're all wrestling, and I was like, oh my, what is this? And I would later get my first copies of Slash magazine there. Slash magazine was a seminal L.A. punk magazine, and that really inspired me to do my own magazine. So I would smuggle Slash magazine, which was, mind you, the size of the City Pulse, into my classes over at Erickson Hall. I was an elementary education major, and I would somehow manage to read it unbeknownst to the professor, sort of the punk equivalent of the Mad magazine inside the notebook. But so I have Punk and MSU and Touch and Go, all of my classes, I learned how to write. My dearly departed mother, who died a month ago, helped me to be the wordsmith I am today. She would not approve of this, however. She is rolling over in her grave because someone said to me, you know, she's looking down on you now, watching you perform. And I'm like, oh, my God. Oh, my dad. So anyway, I try not to think about that. I won't bore you with my views on religion. But anyway, my name is Tesco V. My real name is Bob Vermeulen. I was born in Kalamazoo, Michigan, in a very strict Dutch Reformed household. Thus, my knee-jerk reaction to organized religion, because it was force-fed and shoved down my throat. So guess what? I rebelled. And how? Music has always been a huge part of my life. I remember moments in my life when I've just had this catharsis where I've just felt like spellbound. I remember Chubby Checker when I was 5, the Beatles when I was 9, Strange Brew by the Cream, sitting in the bathtub on my little 9-transistor radio, and when it was Sunshine of Your Love came on, I just remember thinking, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard in my life. And the 70s became this decade where every type of music was available and born. You had hardcore, you had heavy metal, you had punk rock, you had ska, you had rockabilly, you had every revival, and it was just in glam rock. It was a wondrous decade. I jumped on board. I've been a passionate about music. When punk hit, boom, Flat Black and Circular got my entire progressive rock collection. Stacks 2 feet high because I needed money to buy punk records. So, Rob Peter to pay Paul. Now I wish I had those progressive rock albums back, but that's another story. So, this book, if I come off like a self-aggrandizing asshole, it's because I'm really proud of this. The fact that it's already sold out of its first pressing of 4,000, the fact that we have 5,000 more coming, and the fact that it will probably outsell Hank Rollins, Get in the Van, by the time it's all said and done. So fuck you, Henry, wherever you are. He's only sold 18,000 in the last 20 years, so. And that's one of those must-reads. So anyway, I know it was number one on the Amazon punk book list, and I don't know how, you know, there's lots of books about punk that are out there. But what I think this book does a really good job of is showing you the chronology of punk through our eyes, from when we started in the fall of 1979 through 1983. And you can really follow the chronology of American hardcore, how it went down. I mean, the whole internet has changed everything, some positive, some negative. The internet will see to it that something like this, a scene like happened back then, will never happen again, because it immediately exposes any kind of a new music or a new culture, and it's bastardized and rendered passé within 24 hours. Whereas back in the day, hardcore was allowed to kind of percolate, fungate, come to fruition, become an animal in and of its own, and we were all a part of it. It just felt like we were part of something special. It's kind of a cliche once again, but there was so much music coming out. I mean, and so much independent music. It was truly an out with the old and in with the new kind of a attitude that we had. Fuck the past. Let's go forward. And so that's, you can feel the spirit in here. I mean, people are shocked that they think of Touch and Go, hardcore homies. No, not necessarily. The first U2 single gets a positive review in here. I mean, if we liked it. Echo and the Bunnymen, The Fall, The Mekons. Didn't matter what it was. The softer options also got positive press in Touch and Go. So, published by Bazillion Points, a boutique publisher out of New York City, who did the Encyclopedia of Heavy Metal, did the Hellhammer book, did the Andy McCoy from Hanoi Rocks, lots of rock books, but he was the only person. It took us 5 years to sell this baby. 5 years. And we had some big publishers that were on board. They saw the content, and they were like, they saw the picture of Farrah with cum gushing out her ears, and they were like, maybe not. So smaller publishers that wanted to truncate it, make it smaller, say, do a best of, no, sorry. So we stuck to our guns, and Bazillion Points has been exactly what the doctor ordered. So let's take a look. I got some slides here and just some graphics. Influences. Anybody know who that is? Lester Bangs, yes. Lester Bangs was a guy who was dead, I think, by the time he was 38 from drugs and alcohol. Infamously wrote a really negative review of the MC5 album, and for that I can forgive him because of the T-shirt he's wearing. ABBA's my favorite band. Everyone knows that. But his style of journalism certainly left its mark on me because I grew up reading Cream and magazines of that ilk. And Lester Bangs, well, he was the primary purveyor of the record review that had nothing to do about the record. I'm sure you've read those types of reviews. Like, you know, I had diarrhea as I slept, and my underpants were caked to my butt when I woke up, and that's the review or something to that effect. Sorry, it's like wallowing in the mud, literally. But that was the kind of you'll see a few of those in Touch and Go. If I really hated a record, I would put a picture of it. I would do a review of it, but it would have nothing to do with the record. So for that, it's his fault. Next slide, please. Slash magazine, like I said, that's Dick Denny of the Weirdos. That's the magazine that inspired me to do my magazine. Chris D. from the Flesh Eaters on the left, and Claude Bessie, a.k.a. Kickboy Face. These two guys, once again, were big inspirations on me. The whole, just reading their reviews and how they approached the whole thing inspired me to be a writer. This was the actual postcard that I received from Kickboy Face. It was a happy day. I still have it. It's in the book. We sent them number one, and we remember that getting reviewed in Slash Magazine really blew things up for us. We started to get lots of records in the mail, and that was what it was all about, free promo copies, the plugs, the Minutemen, just everything. And that's what was cool about having a fanzine. You got other fanzines, and you reviewed. It was kind of an incestuous relationship. Everybody reviewed each other's fanzines, and so I'm like, well, I want to get more records, so I'm going to start my own record label, and that's another story. So we'll talk about that in a sec. This was my very first foray into writing a fanzine done on that glossy Xerox paper on the old drum copier. I was a fanatic about this band from England called 999. They actually played here at Dooley's in the basement, which is now Harper's. I met them, I hung out with them, I had dinner. Well, I didn't have dinner with them, but I sat there while they ate. Asked them questions like a rabid little fanboy that I was, and went up in my room and did this 4-page fanzine, and once again, not great, but I actually took that picture myself. I'm proud of that, down at Bookies in Detroit, and this is what started it all. This is the house that Touch and Go was made in. Seems kind of silly, but hey, it's right there on Putnam Street in Williamston, formerly owned by the Van Buren family, the president's, some relatives of the president's. That second floor window, I had my drum set in there, and I was sitting there and play the drums and my leopard skin T-shirt, and I'm sure got a lot of stares. I was a third grade school teacher at the time, so there was this huge Worlds Collide thing going on. Mr. V is a school teacher, and he's also doing this punk fanzine, and then I began doing a punk band, so I knew the writing was on the wall. I wouldn't be there much longer. I actually snuck into the elementary school to print the issues in the middle of the night, so, yeah, living on the edge. First issue looks more like an art magazine than a punk magazine. I don't know where I got the name. I don't know why I have the little whatever you call it, or what is that?
Yeah.
I don't know. Touch and Go was a magazine song. It was Howard Devoto and the Buzzcocks band. And I don't know why I came up with Touch and Go. Not that original of a name, but there it is. 50 cents. I think we made 50 copies. So if you can find an issue of number one, well, you were in Fat City until the book came out. Now it's not worth nearly as much as it was. Kill the Hippies. I just want to read this first paragraph. This is by Dave, my partner in crime, and I think this kind of sums it up. You hippies long for the days of peace and music and love. Those which were embodied within the Woodstock Festival. Unable to relive that era, you cling desperately to its music or a variation on the same theme. It's like dragging around the corpse of your dead dog, hoping to perpetuate that old feeling between you and your pet. All that happens is that the stench becomes more and more vile. Dry up and blow away because there's no place for you. The new music is here, and it's here to stay. And we've railed against WILS, Brad Curtis, David Winkelstern, who wrote, I think he wrote for the State News. And it was just like, it was a local thing. We just hated him. So we wrote bad stuff about him because we could, because it was our magazine. And we were pompous asses in a certain respect. It was kind of like, we know about this music and we want to teach everybody about it. But we sort of came off like dicks. But looking back, I'm not ashamed of it at all. The top and the bottom 40 was a fixture of every issue. There we have Debbie Harry as a Playboy bunny. And as you can see, this was a very arbitrary, very subjective list of who I was in love with and who I hated on this any given month. And you'll see things on there, and I'll be like, well, I'll see Ian Hunter, or I'll see something on there that was on the bottom. Or Blue Oyster Cult on the bottom 40. Wait a minute. Is it too late to switch these around? But it was just kind of a, once again, this is like, I don't know if you ever heard the term shotgun journalism, but that's what fanzines were and fanzines are. It's just like a cut and paste. And it certainly wasn't my idea. You can see that it's many came before. Touch and Go was just my take on the whole thing. You load up your blunderbuss with typeface and blast it at the page, and here's what you have. You can see the ones that are type were the ones that I came out. Oh, smelly Arabs. I'm in trouble on that one. Meat rack bars and French people pulling balls of hair. Anyway. Next. Ira Robbins. Oh, this is a good one. The rock and roll bank robber was a contributor from L.A. Who was actually a bank robber. Man, good move, Tesco. Let's get a known felon writing for the magazine. Well, he went on a crime spree. The FBI broke into his last known residence and found letters from me in there. So the next thing I knew, there were FBI agents swarming my little neighborhood. I'm a school teacher, remember, holding up an 8x10 of Shane Williams, the rock and roll bank robber, holding a pound of weed. First of all, who takes a picture of themselves holding a pound of weed? I'm a school teacher. Uh-oh. Next thing I know, my dad calls me and said, yeah, we got a problem, Bob. I just got a death threat. Someone just said they were going to cut my balls off. My dad was the superintendent of Okemah Schools. And someone called him and said they were going to, so I said, oh. So anyway, long story short, the bank robber had his 18-year-old girlfriend in tow on these jobs. The 18-year-old girlfriend's dad was the one who was making all these calls. He called me and threatened the same thing to me. So the FBI came to my house, put a wiretap on my phone, put a wiretap on my dad's phone, and the calls, of course, stopped because the FBI, I'm sure, was in cahoots with the girl's dad. But anyway, yeah, I had a gun under my pillow for a little while, and so that was kind of weird, all because of doing a fanzine. See, it can be a life and death situation being a publishing your own magazine. So, live reviews were a fixture. The cramps at Bookies. I still remember that night fondly. You can hit the next slide. This was our first offset printing. Jello Biafra of the Dead Kennedys taking a poopy. Issue number 10. Looking pretty slick from all of a sudden, isn't it? Stole that picture. I don't remember from where. It certainly wasn't our.
Price went up.
Price went up, yeah. A whopping quarter. This is another one of our local diatribes against Brad Curtis. I've always loved that picture of Marlon Brando with the look on his girlfriend's face is priceless. Penelope Houston, the singer from the Avengers. Regardless of her sexual persuasion, she was every boy's fantasy, punk rock chick. Talking on the princess phone, she took time out so they could snap her mug. She's still out there doing it, too.
So did you have, were these pictures yours?
See, I do not remember where they came from. They weren't sent to us. They were probably just stolen from other magazines. Oh, and then, of course, you know, I don't think you'd want to do something like this nowadays, but pre-Photoshop, it was just cut it out and glue it on the body. Reagan was very hated by the whole punk rocker thing. It was like lots of anti-Reagan stuff, which I always thought was kind of stupid. Because politics was never part of my attack strategy. I had other targets in mind, like the Beatles and crippled children. Next slide. Typical 45 review page. We reviewed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these things. And, I mean, how many of these bands have you even heard of? There's Cabaret Voltaire, there's Medium, Reptile Ranch, My Captains, Religious Overdose, The Bronx, Happy Squid Sampler. So it's like we wallowed in obscurities. We went to Dearborn Music, Wax Trax, every record store we could, and reviewed records. I always say it's akin to being in one of those booths where the money's flying around. Well, just imagine it's 45s. That's how we felt. Yes, question.
That format, you know, with the pasted on paragraphs and stuff like that, reminds me of old British zines. Are you
absolutely
just copying that?
Oh, yeah, pretty much, yeah. And Slash had a similar format, nothing fancy. Yeah. Sometimes we tried to get a little fancy, but when you're stuck with the selector, though I did have the selector with the ball, which you could pop it off and put the italicized ball on there, then you were really getting fancy. I moved to D.C., my wife here, Gerda, I told her, said, I lost my teaching job because of low enrollment out in Williamston, and I got wind that things were happening in the nation's capital, and I said, we're loading up the truck and we're going east, and she said, okay, and Washington, D.C.'s music scene at that time was really exciting. You had lots of great bands. You can see it all over the book, how I went out there and crawled in bed with that whole scene and documented it, covered it, and Minor Threat, for my money, pound for pound, was the best punk rock band that ever walked the planet. They hated each other, and that vitriol came out on stage. Bad Religion, look how young. Anybody know of Bad Religion, I hope? Still out there doing it? Just when they were little puppy dogs sitting on the step of the front house. Of course, I think the singer is the only original member, but a lot of the bands in here still, you know, resonate with the young people. We got Misfits, we got Bad Religion, we got, you know, all the D.C. Midwest bands, well-documented. My shitty crosses with lines from the Misfits. Yeah. The Misfits were like the house band in Detroit, and, you know, nowadays everybody, you know, now Jerry is still going around with Dez from Black Flag and who's playing drums, but it's not really the Misfits. I love Jerry, but come on. Glenn Danzig used to be my friend, but now he's just a big jackass, so we don't talk anymore, but the Misfits were a fixture in our scene, and we covered them. They were great. We went out to the East Coast. We stayed at their house, and it was a great marriage. The beginning of Touch and Go Records, that first Necros 45, it says sold out. There were only 100 copies. You could have had one for $2. The last one that I saw went for sale on eBay, I think went for $3,200. The first Fix record, which says sold out below it, I believe went for $4,200. So those were very limited, and now, sorry, you missed your chance. They sat over there at FBC for months. No one bought them for $2, but you guys weren't born yet, so you have a good excuse. Pusshead, anybody heard of Pusshead, I hope? Yes, no, maybe, artist. From Idaho, believe it or not. Very famous for his Gorillac skateboards. He did Metallica album covers. He's done a whole lot of stuff. And he did a lot of art for me. Lots of babies with skulls, and I don't know, I was never that crazy about his art, but...
Do you know his real name?
Yeah, Brian Schroeder. He did not... respond to my request, or tried to get permission from as many people as I could so I wouldn't get sued. Some fairly famous photographers like Glenn Friedman, Edward Culver, Naomi Peterson, who's dead. I tried to reach out to all the people that would sue me. Yes? Winston Smith?
He did like a lot of the Dead Kennedys stuff.
Oh. Was he still what?
He still had, he was acting in the 70s.
That I'm not sure of. I'm sorry. Ah, this ended my friendship with Henry Rollins, and I don't know why. He left SOA, which was a punk band where he had a bald head and a chain for a belt, and joined Black Flag and grew his hair out. And so I called Pusshead and I said, well, let's gently poke Henry and do. And I commissioned him to do it. Henry called and yelled at me. He called and yelled at Pusshead, and that was 1983. And I've spoken to him a couple times since, but it's a little frosty. But he forgave me and actually wrote a foreword for the book. So it's all good. I'm at the age of my life where I won't say I'm mellowing, but petty feuds, I don't have time for it anymore. Once again, Minor Threat. This was just a best records of the month. I love that picture. It's just very strange facial expression. Henry and Ian on the cover of number 22. This is the second to last issue. They remain best friends to this day. Henry had a phase where he was always clutching a pool ball. I don't know what that means in a psychological, deep-seated sense, but anyway. Question? I think so. But at this point, we were like, you can see it's not stapled. It was actually, offset pressed, and it was stapled. But so yeah, we definitely were coming up in the world. And at this point, we were printing 1,000 of them. So people were buying it. Absolutely, I was getting distribution subscriptions. Most definitely. And we did not limit ourselves to punk rock. There's Mantis from Venom. We liked metal. We did not pigeonhole. If we liked it. We always had our little teen pinup. So there's a heavy metal teen pinup. There's the book. All of its glory. John Brandon on the cover. There were some people that wanted us to put the Ian Henry on there, the one you just saw, but I'm like, no. John Brandon from Negative Approach kind of embodies the whole Midwest hardcore punk rock ethic. And I love that picture. As you can see on the wall, there's some Don Van Vliet graffiti. Anybody know who that is? Very good. Who said that? You win. Captain Beefheart. So the Freezer Theater was a really strange place right down in the crappiest neighborhood in Detroit, but there were some great punk shows down there. Just a few records that made me the man I am today. Go ahead and advance. Anybody ever heard this record? The Bad Brains were four black guys from D.C. that did it better than anyone until they got into their Rastafari and reggae. And then their sets were like half speed punk and half reggae, so the crowd didn't know what to do, and it was like, anyway. That's a great record. Super fast. Middle Class from L.A. It's another like total off the wall, like just blitzkrieg guitar song. I love that cover. It's just so middle class. The Controllers, one of the Controllers was, they're an L.A. band. One of them was actually from Charlotte, Michigan. It's a great record. The Avengers with the aforementioned Penelope Houston. Looking very Christ-like. The Necro's first record. The Fix's first record, the only known copy, sitting in my basement, signed by all four. Mike had to be unique and sign it in the black peckerhead. Oh, how'd that get in there? And yet they're from ABBA. Ooh. Sorry, next. Oh, go to the next slide. And then I have these backwards. The Japanese are coming out with a limited edition box set of all 22 issues as issues, which is really cool. And I'm not sure why, but what crawled up their butt, but they're, they've done a lot of, they've done their homework. They grilled me on paper texture, color of, you know, paper, color of ink. They nailed it as close as they could to the original 22 issues. So it'll be only 500 copies, and the price tag is like $199, which is like, I was like, wow. I mean, it's not my call. I guess there's a collector market out there that has the money to buy it, I hope, and they hope. And then go back one slide. It's also coming out with a limited edition CD of all the bands from back in the day, including the Necros track, Buried Lettuce, have a Necros track, which was huge. Bored Youth, Violent Apathy from Kalamazoo, The Fix from Lansing, great band. Crucifix from Lansing, featuring Doc Dart on the vocals, Black Sheep of the Dart Container family. L7, The Meat Men, my band. Necros and Negative Approach. And that is the end of my crappy slideshow. Any questions or... Yes?
Could you just tell us, like, I don't know, what, like, a typical day or day's work it would be to, like, assemble one of these issues? Like, especially early on before it got a little more professional.
Yeah. You mean just what went into it?
Yeah, I mean, like, what would you do, like, other magazines, stuff out.
Right, right. Well, it's I think it started with the, you know, whatever live reviews and what records I had to do. And then either shoot a photo of the actual record. And Dave had a photography class. He actually printed those offset copies at LCC in his class, in those Necros and Fix sleeves. And so that was a fringe benefit of him having graphics and photography classes. But I did my half, he did his half, and we didn't even talk. I'd say, how many pages you got? He'd say, I got 8. I said, well, do 2 more, because I got 10. And then a week later, we'd get together and, you know, buy a case of Carling's Black Label or whatever, some shitty beer, and we'd sit together, and we'd trade pages and we'd laugh, gratuitously, laugh at each other's stuff. Well, it was fun to see it. But the act of actually putting, I bypassed your question, the act of actually putting it together just involved a lot of the random, you know, perusing through. I got New Musical Express, Melody Maker, and Sounds delivered to my house every week from England, which was like a princely sum at that time because I was making like $9,600 a year as a school teacher. So to get these things but delivered was expensive, but I was so hell-bent on keeping up with what was happening over in England that I once again, pre-internet, and a lot of those pictures came out of all those magazines, including Punk and Bump and Cream and, you know, anywhere I could steal. There are a lot of original photos in the book, too. Gerda, my wife, took some. But a lot of them were, that's why I'm a little like, you know, the book's successful, so I'm like, I don't want it to be too successful. I don't want to get that lawyer letter. We did have to take out some of Brian Pollack, who did all the original "Where the Meat Men and You Suck" album art, and a few of our others. I reached out to him and made him an offer because he had a lot of funny comics in there. Bazooka Morris, where he took Keith Morris and made it into like a bazooka comic, where he, I don't have to drink so much beer, and then throws him showing the beer in the trash can, and then the last frame is "Yes, I do," and he's sitting in the trash can drinking the beer. Just, they were really funny, and I got a lawyer letter from Boogie Bob Baldori's partner, whoever that is. He's a local Lansing guy. And cease and desist, you are not to use my artwork. So 23 pages in the book have been, we took old flyers, everything's period. You'll see some funky, like, black here and there where we had to delete his stuff. It's a damn shame. I don't know what crawled up his crack, but we were friends. He gave me full use of all his artwork. He would call me and say, you want me to do something for the new issue? And then people are strange. Yes? Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you say that because I'm doing the same thing. Maybe it's bias, but to me, as long as the front man is there or the primary component is there, it's always been me and then a cast of characters. So that's really not a good example. And I know Brandon Cruz, the singer, he's a friend of mine, but that was a bad idea to, you know, without Jello Biafra, yeah. I mean, some of it, like the Circle Jerks are basically the same band. They have some different players. As long as Keith Morris is there and Greg Hetson is there. But yeah, it's a mixed bag. Some, you know, DOA is still DOA. Agent Orange is still Agent Orange. You know, some of those legacy bands, you know, are. But then other ones, I'm like, wait a minute. Like, I'm curious if when DRI comes through here, if how many of the original members will be there. But yeah, it's funny because people are very forgiving of their heroes, or if they grew up in the '80s and they love DRI. They'll go and see it because it's just like, but then there's people that are your age that are coming out too. So it's cool. Like we played in San Antonio and there are all these little Hispanic kids like in the front chanting our lyrics. And I'm like, what's going on here? This is weird. Yeah, it's very strange and it's very cool. That's why I'm like, the bar scene is dying in many markets. All ages shows are really where it's at. Because the kids are, you know, they're interested, they're curious. There's nothing else for them to do but pay $10 to go to a punk show. So in many respects, I mean, there's some of the old-timers that come and still come out and see us. But, yeah, it's like it's still fun. 55 years old playing punk rock, go figure. I quit when I was 40. I'm like, I'm 40. This is stupid. This is 1996, you know, and now I'm 55 and I'm like having fun. So it's like, go figure. Have the big one on stage. Hey, that wouldn't be a bad way to die, would it? Hopping around in 130 degrees, you know, with people spitting on you and beer, but it's fun. It's hard to describe. There's no other feeling. It sounds, you know, once again, it's like a cliche, but there's really no other feeling like it. It's like we played at Theater Bazaar on Saturday night. Isn't, you know what that is down in Detroit? It's a, well, it was like a five-city block. It took a five-city block area of Detroit, made it into like a 1930s Coney Island. I mean, everything. They even brought in a Ferris wheel from New York. And they have like sword swallowers and flame spitters and burlesque dancers and sideshow freaks. Well, at the last minute, they called the city and said, well, we want to use the old state fairgrounds to park. And they said, for what? They've been doing this 10 years, mind you. Well, we have this little thing called Theater Bazaar, and the city came in. The city of Detroit came in and slapped, you know, about 100 code violations on them. So with one day to spare, they moved the whole thing to the Fillmore, which is the grand old theater. And so we got to play in front of the biggest crowd I've ever played in front of. There was like 2,000 people in Halloween costumes are on Saturday night. And it's like probably three quarters of them didn't know who the hell I was. And I'm out there, you know, it's like, God, pinch me. This is some, you know, we're playing some, and we played Riot Fest in Chicago. That's a big deal. So it's like, it's fun. I'm having fun. And it's weird, though. It's a world collide. When you play those mixed crowds, some of the stuff I say on stage, because Tesco V is, yeah, it's very out, you know, I'm out there, I'll admit it. Tesco V and Bob Vermeulen kind of are, you know, Tesco V is kind of a skin that I crawl into when I hop on stage. And some of this, I say some pretty outlandish, outrageous things, get a rise out of people, kind of like what I did with my magazine. My band was an offshoot of the magazine. Well, I want to do this too, this punk rock. Everybody's doing it. That was the mentality that was out there. Except for me, it wasn't about Reagan and politics. It was about, you know, poop humor, boners, things like that. That was important to me. I was raised on the Fugs and Mothers of Invention and bands that had a sense of humor. And that's to me, that's what the Meat Men are. It's like the Mothers of Invention sped up, or as it were, Frank Zappa was truly a legend. He's greatly missed every day. But anyway, any other questions? Yes. Just Dave and I. And then we actually gave the Rock and Roll Bank Robbers some editor credits for a while, but that was over when the FBI swooped down on them.
Well, I think you do need to clarify that when you first contacted him or vice versa, he was in jail. You were just being his
good point.
Pal.
Good point. I started out as a pen pal.
And he got out of jail.
And he got out, and he was in L.A., so he was writing L.A. scene reports. It was like, you know, it was cool. Because, like I said, it was like the Pony Express days. You didn't have, how am I going to get these L.A. scene reports? I need to know somebody in L.A. Well, here's a guy in L.A. We got lots of unsolicited stuff sent to us, too. A lot of artwork and stuff you see in there was just people, like, you know, doodle drawings that we thought were funny, so we stuck them in the magazine. So, yeah, it did start off, I forgot that, it did start off as a pen pal. And he actually came up to us. We played in L.A. a couple years ago, and he walked up to me at the back of the club, and I was like, oh, my God, it's the Rock and Roll Bank Robber. I said, are you out? He's like, are you going to stay out this time? Come on, dude. So he said, yeah, I'm going to stay out this time. So,
yeah. Just this kind of related. The book has an editor. What did the editor do?
The editor is Steve Miller, who was the singer of The Fix, and he just kind of... 5 years ago, Steve and I were standing in the Kinko's over on Harrison doing some, putting together some proposals, some treatment, you know, some select pages to mail out. And he was kind of the proponent of the book. And he's the one that hooked me up with my lawyer who eventually sold the book. So, and he assembled it and he contacted all the, you know, the Henry Rollins, Byron Coley, Corey Rusk, all the people that wrote forwards, kind of organized it, worked with the graphics guy. So, yeah, Gerda said last night, he's lucky he put his... I shouldn't say that, this might go on the web. Strike that from the record. No, he did a lot. He really did. And so his name is on the cover. Oh, yeah, this is going on the web. Shit. Can we have a do-over? That's the thing. I hate YouTube because I go out there and play a show, and the next day I log on, and there's some clip of it, and it just sounds like shit. You know what I mean? Can I, like, anybody, any asshole with a phone, and I see them, they're like, the whole show, they're like this. Are you enjoying yourself? Because it looks like you're not. Anyway, sorry. Fucking YouTube, what are you going to do? Any other questions, comments, abuse you'd like to heap on me? Speaking of abuse, I really haven't gotten as much as I should have from some of the things I've said. Some of the incendiary, volatile, over-the-top things that I've said, but occasionally I really rankle. You know, the PC, it's so PC out there nowadays. It's another reason why I am a necessary thing, evil, because it's ridiculous. It's gotten to the point where it's just ridiculous. And I don't, and I'm not a racist, I'm not a sexist, I'm not a homophobe. Some people might think I am. In real life, I'm like the most live and let live left-wing Democrat you've ever met. But what Tesco V says things, it's kind of like Larry David, you know, the whole Curb Your Enthusiasm, saying things that you think but don't, but shouldn't say. That's kind of what the Meat Men and kind of what Tesco V is all about.
And
yeah.
Would have edited yourself now?
Yeah, definitely. Like the picture of Muhammad Ali and John Lennon and Lennon's, the balloon says, what's it like being black? And Ali says, better than being dead. So now I looked at that and I was like, well, wait a minute. Lennon had just gotten killed, so that's why I said that. But yeah, there's some things in there that somebody actually... One of our scene contributors, one did a Bad Brain for you, and he actually dropped the N-word in there, and we almost didn't catch it until the last minute. And like, there's an N-word in here. We can't. Are you kidding? So you know, it's like, it was. I mean, I don't use that word, but so we had to, you know, Photoshop the typeface and change it to black just in time. I mean, if that had gone, if that, I don't remember if that went out to the publishers or not, but if it did, I can see why they rejected us. But yeah, the racial thing is like, it's again, stay away from it. Make jokes, but don't be racial. Yes.
Did you ever get a job as a teacher again?
No, I didn't. I went out east and I tried. And actually, I came back in 99 and I worked at the East Lansing Schools for a year. And I thought, I'm going to go back to state. I'm going to work on my master's. I'm going to teach. So I came back and started working on my master's. And I was a parapro. And then I got this job offer in telecommunications. And it was like, I realized that I did no longer had the patience for children. 8 kids in this class were on medications. And it was just like a constant, like, no. I'm too old for this. I've lost my nurturing spirit. Yes?
Like punk rock today for like me and my brother is like different from what punk rock was way back when. Do you think like the invention of like the internet has been like a good or a bad thing for bands nowadays? Or?
I mean, it's good for promotion. I mean, it's great for promotion, and I'm taking advantage of it. But to me. It's lost its danger, if you know what I mean. Like to me, a good punk show, there's a certain measure of threat where you feel like your safety might be in jeopardy. Like, and that was my benchmark for what was a good punk show. And it's like I don't feel that intensity. Maybe I'm not going to the right punk shows, but punk is such a ubiquitous term. It really doesn't mean what it used to. I mean, punk is everything from, like, I mean, they call Green Day punk, and they call, you have NOFX, and you have, the Riverboat Gamblers, and you have all these bands that are called punk, but I guess it's just, it's all a category, it's all just however you view it, but the internet, I think, is good for, it's great for promotion, but like I said before, it's bad as far as, getting any kind of a music scene going in a certain community because it's way too immediate.
Are there any shows in particular that stick out to you and you're like, that was like one of the most, I was afraid I was going to get my skull cracked?
Oh, yeah. The shows that, like that Minor Threat picture when it said fucking DC, those shows at the old 930 club were like that, where you were like, if you went venture down into the pit, and it was just packed in there. There were guys that thought it would be a good idea to put spurs and sharpen them on their boots, and there was a couple of guys that got like the tops of their ears cut off, and it's like, well, that's just stupid. But like I said, there were some shows in New York where the DC kids all came and thought they were going to mess with the New York crowd, and there was like full scale. I was at shows where there were riots. I was on stage. This is a good story. At the local 186 in Cambridge in 1995 or 96. And there's these gangs in major markets. There's one in Boston. There's one in L.A. There's a gang in Boston called FSU. They're anti-racist skinheads. Okay? Think about that.
Is it Front Stand United? Is that what it
is? I believe it is. So anyway, If they think you're at all like racist, or if you're like a Gigi Allen, or you're the Mentors, or you're the Meat Men, we're out to get you, because they think I'm a racist, even though I'm really not. But anyway, this had nothing to do with that whole stance. The FSU were the security at this local 186. Well, they got fired the night before for something, so the whole security got fired. Well, the new security came in the next night, which was the night we played. And FSU all walked in with their tickets and came in like patrons. And, of course, the new security didn't know who they were. So these guys are all, like, in the crowd, and they're going to fuck shit up. Sorry, for want of a better term. So in the middle of our set, something gets lobbed at my bass player. He takes a water bottle and then chucks it and hits this FSU guy in the head. Well, it's on. Full scale, like, you've seen the scenes in the movies, the Wild West movies, where the whole bar is fighting? I'm not exaggerating. The entire bar is fighting. Guys are taking bar stools and, all the rows of alcohol bottles, smash. guys running down the bar and diving onto a pile of people fighting. My bass player, we have him by the legs. They have him by the arms. They're trying to drag him out in the alley to whatever. I mean, I got punched in the face. It had like a 6-foot stage. Well, I got punched in the face. Some guy just came up and punched me, knocked me off. I started to climb back on stage, not sure why. And the security herded me to the back room. But anyway, needless to say, that was the last night of the local 186. And to this day, I have to get permission from FSU to play in Boston or Providence. They still wield a bunch of power. You've heard of a band called Slapshot? Slapshot was going to play a show, and this just happened recently. FSU said, if Slapshot, this is a big show, like 2,500 kids. It was like Gangrene and all the old Jerry's Kids. If Slapshot steps on that stage, we will shoot them on stage. So everybody's like, yeah. So they're going to go on. Yeah, I don't, I'm not going to worry about that. FSU gets through like 3 layers of security, confronts their manager, says if they go on stage, we will shoot them. So they didn't play. So anyway, I love gangs. Stuff happens. And we were, one more gang story. 2 years ago, we were going to play in Pomona, California. The same thing happened. We got a tip that someone was going to cause us bodily harm. And I had my son and my nephews with me. So anyway, enough of that. Any other questions? Well, thank you for coming. We have books.